Welcome to Change Your Story, the podcast dedicated to anyone ready to redefine their career path. Now, according to Gallup, we spend over 81,000 hours working during our lifetime, and yet only 1 in 10 of us actually love what we do. My name's Carolyn Parry, and I'm an award-winning career and life coach, author, and speaker on a mission to help those who are unhappy at work. And that's because I know what it feels like. Now, fortunately, I found a way to transform the successful but soul-eroding business career that burnt me out into a 20-year-plus career I'm passionate about because it aligns with who I really am and my desire to help other professionals find something more meaningful so they can escape the hamster wheel too. So settle back, get comfortable, and join me and my inspirational guests as we share powerful stories, strategies, and insights to help you find your inspiration so you can create a career that brings you joy too. Welcome to Change Your Story. So welcome back to a brand new series, Series 2. Now you may be wondering why there's been such a heck of a gap between Series 1 and Series 2. And it is with very good reason, because I've spent quite a lot of time, it has to be said, with my head buried into my computer, writing and then publishing my first book, Change Your Story. And yes, it does have the same name as the podcast. Well spotted for anybody going, I've heard that before somewhere. Now Change Your Story actually contains 8 inspirational career stories, many of which came from the podcast Series 1, and there are some extra stories in there as well. And the aim of the book is to provide inspiration and motivation to anyone who is lost or struggling in their career. There's over 30 activities, and there are pages of different career roles that you could look at and consider that are careers that are all designed to make a difference, and in fact relate to the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, the 17 biggest problems the world has that have absolute longevity. So if you're looking for a career that's going to last, have a look at one of those. I'm absolutely delighted to say that Change Your Story is getting 5-star reviews on Amazon, and readers are reporting that they found it to be motivational, inspiring, empowering, encouraging, and in one case, life-changing. And that's exactly why I wrote the book, to help people who are struggling, a little bit lost, confused. This will give you a route to a future that you actually enjoy rather than one that you endure. I'll pop a link to the book and more information on it in the show notes for today. So that's why I've been very quiet for the last few months. But rest assured, I have a cracking set of guests lined up for you for the next few months. And I'm absolutely delighted to be starting today with Dr. Clive King as my first guest in the new series. Now, Clive describes himself as a lifelong contrarian and techie. He spent nearly all of his working life working in the computing industry. That started in 1990. During that time, he supported international clients all around the world working for Sun Microsystems, who, for those who follow the tech profession, will know that that became part of Oracle in 2010. And yet he's done all of this supporting clients globally, as I say, but never moved from his home just outside Aberystwyth. So we're going to explore that as one of the themes today. What Clive discovered is that when you become a specialist and expert in a particular niche, you're highly sought after. And that knowledge and experience has also given him the opportunity to support the next generation of aspiring computer science students as an honorary fellow of Aberystwyth University. And it's there that he studied his PhD in computer science, along with the man behind the code compiler for the Ada programming language, Dr. Ian Pyle. Now, it's fair to say that Clive likes a challenge. He became an ultra runner, completing the Bob Graham Round, the 66-mile, 27,000-feet circuit of 42 of the highest peaks of the English Lake District within 24 hours. He's a martial arts specialist, a climbing enthusiast, and unsurprisingly perhaps, as you would probably imagine, a lover of complex problems and solving them. Now, after all of that career being employed by one of the world's biggest and most respected computer science organisations, at the tender age of 55 in 2023, Clive took a decision that he was going to step away from the security of employment and become a contractor, carrying on solving complex problems for clients again globally, partly because it's given him some time and freedom to do more of what he loves, including being a dirtbag rock climber, training his spaniel, and continuing to be the curator of TEDx Aberystwyth. Clive, a very, very warm welcome to you today. Lovely to see you. How are you doing? Are you well?
Thank you for inviting me. It's the nearest I'll ever get to Desert Island. I'm very well, thank you.
Let's call this the careers version of Desert Island Discs, shall we? So, take us back to when your story began. What was your childhood like?
So I was born in and brought up in a small hamlet with, I think, four elderly families around us and farms. And I took an interest in farming and I spent time playing in woods. And I was certainly not a 3A level student. And it was an outdoor childhood and fishing, working on the farm. And I really didn't wake up to anything academic or that was commercially useful until I was at university. And I took a lot of the ethics and the hard work and adaptability from the farm and working with a couple of farmers. So, yeah, it was quite a non-standard childhood, being effectively an only child. My brother is 15 years older than me. It was really good.
It sounds idyllic and the sort of thing that a lot of people would love to be able to do with their kids as well, I'm sure. What is it your parents did?
My father was a BBC transmitter engineer, so a very much an electronics problem solver. He retired, funnily enough, at 55 and started his own business repairing agricultural electronic equipment, which my brother has since taken over and expanded 100-fold into an incredibly successful business. And my mum, basically, I think she took other people's jobs. So if they were ill, she would step into them. And I think that was something that could be done in the 70s and 80s.
Isn't that interesting that you've ended up working in tech and that's what your dad was involved with, the electronics engineer, but you didn't follow quite in his footsteps. In fact, you chose something different for A-level, didn't you?
So I think my attention was often elsewhere, out on the farm. And so I did geography and geology as A-levels, and I got enough grades to get into what was Staffordshire Polytechnic. So I moved on to the geography degree. It was fine, made some great friends, which I still have. But I think I worked out that I didn't want to be a geography teacher and any of the other careers that geography offered me. So I went and did a master's in computer conversion master's at Birmingham University. And I think that's really where I found my calling, career-wise anyway.
So how did you know it was computer science? Because, you know, back then it still wasn't an obvious choice. It's a very young profession still. It's been going, what, 50, 55 years or so, 60 years. So it's still quite a young profession. Why computer science? What was the trigger for you to go, yeah, I'm going to go to Birmingham. It is that conversion master's I want to do?
I don't think you're going to like the answer to this, because there was a girl I really liked who was interested in it, and so I kind of followed along in on that. And I think you get the ideas from very strange places, but we went to very different places and other ends of the country. And I think that, if I'm honest, that's where the idea came from.
And there's nothing wrong with that at all, Clive, to be absolutely honest.
Well, there's an awful lot wrong with that, but that's another story.
Let's be clear, people's career choices come from all sorts of influences, and significant friends and family are definitely in that group. And then there's also this thing called planned happenstance, where there's a little bit of synchronicity happens and you bump into somebody and they suggest something, you go, oh, that's a good idea, I'm up for that, I'm open to ideas, I'm going to go there. So what was it like doing the Masters at Birmingham? What did you gain from that?
It was packing 2 and a bit years of a degree into 12 months. And I really enjoyed my time at Birmingham, I think far more than I had in Stoke. Learned to work a lot harder. And at the end of it, it kind of seemed obvious to me to combine geography and computing. And I applied to the Ordnance Survey in Southampton and got a job there. And it was an interesting place. On the first day you get your welcome letter, where it managed to include the word thrift in the first paragraph. As a job, I was some great people and I learned some technology, which got me the next step. But I remember waking up one morning having had a dream that I had gone into the office and they'd said, oh, here's your gold clock. Take the rest of the day off to plan your retirement. And I said, but I'm only 23. And I sort of woke up in a sweat and I went in and resigned the next day. And from that day to this, I have absolutely no regrets about doing that. I think it was after about 5 months and brother didn't speak to me for 9 months. And I went to work on a farm for 6 months because I thought, I've never worked on a farm in May. I've always been doing exams. And my father just happened to see an advert in the local paper. And he says, oh, that sounds like what you do. And it was a job in the university at Aberystwyth computer science department, and I applied for it. And I didn't get the job, but they were impressed enough with my experience with the Ordnance Survey to find enough money for a year. And that led me on to a phase of life and a job. And I think there's three times in my life I've had sort of 6 month periods where early in that particular job, it's just been so much fun. And I had two at Sun in two different jobs, and working as a Unix system administrator at Aberystwyth initially in about 1992 was just so much fun. And then you get more responsibility and things get just more challenging.
So is there perhaps a need for you to have that balance between fun and challenge, but not so much that the weight of that challenge takes away the fun? Is there something there that's important to you?
I think things change as you get older. I know when Oracle took over Sun Microsystems, and I would have been in my 40s, the things that were important there is paying expenses on time, an easy-to-use expenses system. It was a more grown-up company. It was a lot less fun, but that suited me at that point where I wasn't as aligned to the company as I had been earlier. So I think as you get older, maybe you look more outside work for your kicks.
Interesting. How did you make that leap from Aberystwyth to Sun? Because you were working and studying at the same time in Aberystwyth, weren't you?
The sequence of events that I remember, and they can always be distorted, is that I was a research associate. I wanted to become a lecturer. A lecturing post came up. I applied, and the head of department, bless him, Frank Bott, came and told me, well, I'm just going to reject your application. Thank you for applying. Now, if you finish your PhD and get a years of industrial experience, then we'll make you a job in the computer science department as a lecturer. And I thought, oh, great. OK. And that's what prompted me to go and look outside academia. And then I discovered two things. One is watching other academics like my wife is they have to work pretty hard, certainly a lot harder than I had to work. And I wasn't really suited to it. And I was actually quite good at solving problems and technical problems and interfacing with people and making them comfortable and getting their buy-in. So I left Aberystwyth Computer Science Department, then 26 years later kind of came back. And sometimes I think you can set off on a particular journey and find that, actually, I'm just going to carry on. I may have set out to do this as experience, but actually I found pretty much what I want to do.
You talked there about solving complex problems. Where did your interest in that come about? Because it strikes me that that's a thread that goes through everything you do, whether it's the climbing or martial arts, or it's working in Sun or Oracle, we'll come on to later, or contracting. There is a problem-solving theme through there. So where did the problem-solving interest come from, and how did you know you were good at it?
I'm not naturally good at it. I've worked with people who are world-class, and their brains just work. They absorb technical information, they can learn new technology. And I was lucky enough to be able to train as a Kettner-Trago program leader. So if you've seen Apollo 13, the film, and they're hurtling towards the moon and oxygen tanks go pop, what the film misses out is that there was a process that two social anthropologists called Mr. Kettner and Mr. Trago came up with in the 50s. And it looks at what people are successful in business do in terms of solving problems, making decisions, assessing risk, managing other people. And I was lucky enough to be trained in that process within some microsystems where it was rolled out. And it was life-changing because as a species, we're typically not very good at solving problems. And I trained to teach it and I trained to facilitate it. And that meant I could keep up with people who were much better at solving problems, much brighter, more experienced. And I could be the glue between them. I'd understand when somebody was talking about their 20,000 lines of device driver. I wouldn't understand how they got there, but I'd be able to communicate it to people who were completely non-technical. Or I'd be able to take two people who were very technical in their own domains and join them together. And so my problem solving was, you know, by normal standards, on a scale of 1 to 10, it was a 9. But I was working with people who were properly a 10. And the Kettner-Trago rational process allowed me to do that. And it's been sort of one of the underpinning parts of my career. I've taught both my children the process. I'm not sure that's recommended because they start picking you up when you ask closed questions when you should be asking open. But that would be one of the things that I found certainly very useful. I don't do advice ever, but that was one area important enough for me to put the time into making sure my kids have a grounding in it.
You use the phrase life-changing, and it sounds to me that part of what makes you special in your career is that ability to facilitate understanding and communication that ties people together. Is that a fair comment?
I think partly. I think there are many bits. One is very, very rarely saying no. And I have my kind of principle of 10. If you say yes to almost everything, there'll be three or four things that will never happen, but you'll get credit for them. Two or three of them will be really good. One or two will be marginal and one will be horrid. But it's worth volunteering for them all.
Worth volunteering for them all because?
In aggregate, you gain. And one of them will be horrid and you will regret it. But one of them will involve a trip to South Africa where at the weekend you get to go to the Pilanesberg National Park. And that's the opportunities you get by volunteering for almost everything.
Is that also a way of learning for you as well? That saying yes to almost anything, even if it's horrid?
I think so. I think from about the age of 40, I've had to try very hard to get myself into situations which are very uncomfortable, and particularly in a work context. Other than, everybody who works in a large company gets uncomfortable interpersonal situations. They just come with the territory.
So they come with the territory, that interpersonal challenge. Did you bump into any of those around the merger process when Sun became part of Oracle? Because that's very typically what happens in corporate careers. First-hand experience speaking here. I wonder whether that's something that you've experienced as well in that particular moment of merger, or if it's just sort of the general, because teams change and you come across different people.
There's quite a lot of love in my life for Oracle still. They handled the merger pretty well. Pretty much the management structure was kept in place. I was an individual contributor, but I was reporting at director and VP level. And at my level, you sort of got one or two levels up until you came to established Oracle people. So actually, there was relatively little change. It evolved over time. And they were kept as separate business units, even pretty much to today.
So you went through the merger, still looking for opportunities. Was there any particular opportunity that came to you that wasn't computing related, but came to you because you were in Oracle or Sun?
I was lucky enough to be elected as a pension fund trustee. And so this was part of Sun Microsystems in about 2005. So I had about 5 years as a pension fund trustee. I knew absolutely nothing about how the pension industry works, or I would argue doesn't work very well. And so you're talking to heavyweight advisors. When Oracle took over, we had to have the pension scheme bought out and interviewing pension fund advisors. So there was an awful lot learnt, and I became aware of the importance of pensions early enough to make a difference and how they work. And I wouldn't say how to invest, but that putting money in early enough was really important, and the tax advantages and all that sort of thing. The financial industry, I think, is fundamentally broken. And the only thing I came out with is that ultimately you have to be your own financial advisor, at least for me, and that to learn enough about how that world works that you can spot where you're being misdirected. It is a very broken world from what I've experienced, but there are ways to navigate around it. But it is a huge learning curve. Sun and Oracle were giving me this time, maybe 2 days a month, into attending to pension matters and gaining that understanding.
Yeah, it is complex, isn't it? And I will say, particularly unhelpful if you happen to be a woman who has lots of interruptions in careers and pensions and generally underpaid compared with men, as the statistics show. But don't start me on that one.
I think the important thing I learned is it's almost like the X-Files, trust no one, Mr. Mulder, is that there is no one out there you can trust to give you financial advice.
So do you use any of your Trego techniques when it comes to understanding and your own investment choices?
I think So part of the Cat and Tracker was set about setting objectives. And one of my objectives was to be in the position to retire at 55, or at least semi-retire at 55. And setting that objective early, sort of when I was in my late 30s, was really helpful. And when I did retire, I had a number of options. I had 9. And I remember walking our dog at the time and thinking, oh, I've got this offer and I've got this offer and I've got this combination of offers. What should I do? And I went, this is madness. I need to go back to the objectives. And I went back home. I made a cup of tea. I sat down. I wrote out the objectives I have, which are musts, which are wants, what's the weight of each one. And even just doing that was enough to make the path clear. I carried through the rest of the process and in terms of evaluating alternatives. But I think as a species, we tend to think when we make decisions, we make them on alternatives. That's our natural position. And I've been lucky enough to have a process which, when I crank it up, brings me back to looking at my objectives. And that's been really, really useful. Now, there are houses that we didn't buy because we went back and looked at our objectives. We use it with our daughter in university selection.
You talked about houses that you didn't buy. Tell me a little bit more about that.
So originally in 1992, I bought a small miner's cottage. We got married and was thinking about having children and clearly wanted somewhere bigger. There was a house that came up and it met most of our objectives. It was a little bit far out. So we went through that process and it kind of passed. But there's a second phase where you look at risk and then you ask, are there risks that are unacceptable? And for doing a bit of investigation and walking around the area, we found there was a rather aggressive farmer who owned all of the surrounding land, and he felt that was too big a risk to the type of life we want. I mean, where we are now, we're very, very well with the landowner next door, where he has a sheep that's ill, we'll tell him, and we wander his fields, you know, responsibly, and that's important to us. So the whole Cetnatrago process has highlighted risks that we might otherwise have not gone and asked, awkward questions we wouldn't have asked ourselves.
So a little bit of a guardian angel system in a way to make sure that you keep following the objective and keep that focus. Is that a fair description of it?
I think it's more about thinking rationally. It is called the rational process. And again, we are a bundle of cognitive bias. You know, the recently departed Daniel de Kleinem, who came up with thinking fast and slow, he said our brains, we tend to match patterns. And we may jump to those patterns. I've been really lucky to be taught to teach and practice a process which helps us. It doesn't make us immune to things that we evolved to run away from things that might eat us and towards things that will eat us. So lots of the biases we have, like following confident people without question, these are biases that are hereditary, go back in evolution. And I think, well, I feel quite lucky that I had some of the processes that have helped me fight against that. I'm not, you know, I'm still much, very much work in progress, but it's been one of the sort of themes of my world.
So that connection between rational thinking and problem solving is strong. I'm going to have to ask the question, where does emotion sit in all of this? Where's that emotional purchase, that lean in that direction, just to provide that balance?
Oh, absolutely. So sometimes it doesn't pass the gut field test and you know you've missed something. I was lucky enough to be the fly or train and fix person. So I would get sent to customers by Sun Microsystems and Oracle, and you'd arrive with them and you would solve a problem, but you'd have that gut feeling that there was something more and you were just getting ready to go home, and they would say, oh yes, and there's this. So gut feeling, I think, serves very well, but the challenge is articulating it. And if you are making assumptions, make those assumptions explicit to yourself and those around you. And that, I think that doesn't matter whether you're making personal decisions or in a corporate setting.
So, of course, what you're doing there is exactly what Daniel Kahneman talks about in Thinking Fast and Slow, isn't it? It's integrating systems one, which is that gut feel intuition, with systems two, rational thinking, which is slower and does sometimes come with a negative preset, which is around keeping us safe. But that's the way that that part of the brain has developed as well. Fascinating. In fact, Malcolm Gladwell talks about that a lot in his book Blink, doesn't he? That the importance of gut feel. He tells the story in Blink about somebody who's brought in as an expert to judge whether a piece of allegedly ancient Greek sculpture is actually original or not. And he's the expert that comes in and goes, it's not, but three other experts have gone, it is original. They were basing the assumption on the testing on the material, which showed it was of the period. But the experts looking at the sculpture itself said that is not typical of the work of that artist. It's not using the right way of sculpting. And therefore, it was declared a fraudulent piece and saved the particular museum a fortune because they didn't go ahead with the purchase. It's funny how our brains work, isn't it? We talked about having that focus and objective. Where else do you use that in your life? Where else is that focus and that sort of laser, like I'm going to accomplish this goal?
I think when men get to a certain age, that they have to have a midlife crisis. I think they've also got to have a crisis which involves Lycra. And I was lucky enough to, well, unlucky enough to read a book called Feet in the Clouds, which was given to me by my long-term climbing partner, Tim. And it's about a Guardian journalist who goes off and decides to do this Bob Graham round. And Bob Graham was a 1930s guest house owner in Keswick who went out for a little walk and came back 24 hours later. And it's about retracing his route. And it's a sort of standard fell runner test piece. I'm not a natural runner. I'm not a natural endurance runner. I think one of the biggest compliments of my life was after I'd finished the Bob Graham round, and one of the people who had been supporting us said, oh, you're the one of the sort of the cohort of that year who I didn't expect to do it. But it was a fantastic experience. It took me 3.5 years of training. It took me 3 attempts. I had 2 failed attempts. I made some wonderful friends as an ultra-running journalist called Damien Hall, who says, you know, the friends you make are the ones who won't know your children's birthday, but if you want them to turn up on a mountain in the middle of the night with a bag of food, they'll be there for you. Yeah, you know, I met some wonderful people. There was a friend of mine, Jim, who was doing a record attempt for a North Wales circuit called Paddy Buckley. And I met Jasmine Paris, who was also supporting him. She's just amazing. First woman to finish the Berkeley Marathons in the last week or so. And the Bob Graham round was an awful lot of training. I'd spend days out training. And my wife would say, oh, we're having another holiday in the Lake District in February for you to go and practice the route. I think for me, what was most, and failing twice, and I was always set to fail at least once. If you're a natural runner, you can get round it on your first go. I think only 1 in 3 people tend to get round on the first go. And for me, I had, between my second and third attempt, I had to sort of sit myself down and go, well, why did you fail? And the rather uncomfortable answer was that I was externalizing blame for that failure. I wasn't accepting it as under my control. And so when I came to the third attempt, I had cleared all those things out of my head. And I was unquestionably a better person, not better than other people, but better than I was. And I think people like Damien Hall and Jasmine Paris and all the other people who are at the top end of their sport have cleared all those self-limiting beliefs or all that sort of kludge out of their minds. Because it's such an internal and personal thing. Take Jasmine, she did not run the Berkeley Marathons for anyone else. I know, having met her for a couple of hours, it was an internal thing and it was only done for her. And you can't do something with that much suffering for anyone else. It has to be for you. And I think when one of the things is putting yourself under that stress, it's kind of liberating. It allows you to explore yourself in a way that nothing else does. But it's a once time. That was my only time I'm going to take myself to that level. I don't think your life has that many opportunities unless you are at the top of your game. So yeah, I still run, but I won't be taking on that sort of challenge again. I've been there and done that. There are other things to do.
But there's still that sense of intellectually climbing the summit. isn't there? That sense of you've got to scale the heights of your own inner resistance to get over the line. And I'm going to use that as an extended metaphor now, because you took to another sport, didn't you, which wasn't about running, but it was about climbing. How did you get into that?
I started climbing when I was 16, and I would just look at running and climbing as part of the same sport, or fell running anyway. It's all part of mountaineering. At one end, you have scrambling and running and rock climbing and alpine mountaineering and Himalayan mountaineering and going across the Antarctic. It's all part of the same sport. There's lots of it I don't do, but it's all part of the same mindset. And I really enjoy climbing. You tend to do it with other people. It's quite odd. Climbing partners are not friends. You may share more than you would share with other people, but it's a very different interaction. And I am quite competitive with myself. So I don't care how hard other people are climbing. That's great for them. But I have particular goals that I want to climb. There's two routes in North Wales I want to climb. Actually, three. And there's particular grades that I want to get to before I change direction again.
That's very much that quest for excellence, isn't it? I was listening to you there and you were talking about how climbing is not with friends, it's with, I was going to use the word colleagues. And I was wondering how much the climbing and the running contributed to your ability to be at the top of your game work-wise.
Probably not at all. I think they're separate activities and the crossover is very limited. The only time I can think of the two crossing over was being able to run a mile across Chicago Airport to get a flight that I would have otherwise missed. I don't think the two cross over at all. And I think that's really nice. I see them as completely different things.
Interesting, because I'd have looked at those and gone, isn't there a question of tenacity when you're running and tenacity when you're landing a big project or you're trying to solve something really complex and move something that has time critical, cost critical elements to it. So that's why I was coming at it that way. It was that mindset stuff that you gain from running and climbing, and whether some of that had crept across, maybe unconsciously actually, Clive, into the work.
I think they're different. For me, they're different because running, climbing is a very internal thing. You won't explain why you go climbing or do something like the Bob Graham Round. It's such an internal thing. But the solving problems is external. You are involved with other people. There is a point to it. So I see these as different strands of one life that very, very rarely touch each other.
Interesting. So it does beg the question, given that you've worked in the computer industry since 1990, and although you used the word retirement earlier, we know that you're not retired, and we'll explore a bit more about that in a minute. But how do you stay in one industry doing well over that length of time?
I don't know. But what I did was I evolved slowly. I think there's an element of luck. I had some very good managers. I had two really bad ones as well, but didn't have them for long. But I had some excellent managers, VPs, directors, and they got the value. And I think I am also unmanageable. So for the sort of traditional management, I would drive that manager wild and they would drive me to leave. I was really lucky in that I had a series of managers and directors who pointed me in a particular direction and then signed my expenses off and said, if there's anything you need, give me a shout. So I can be directed. So that's the goal. Get there. You know, as long as you don't do anything illegal, find your own direction. But I certainly could not be managed. That's true of many senior techies. And of course, an awful lot of friction.
Is that desire to just be able to get on with it down to valuing freedom?
It's hard to say. One of the really lucky things I had with Sun Microsystems and all the way through my career in Oracle is I was the engineering liaison for two really large financial data providers in New York. And so, in effect, I was living in Mid Wales and my job was in New York. And the tenacity there becomes just being able to deal with the additional travel and being able to put up with that. But these were fantastic working relationships where we, in effect, saved the two companies from self-harming each other. And that was, in effect, our jobs. And that was probably the most rewarding and it was extended for sort of 11, 12 years, part of my career. There's still people in New York I would consider my friends. And that, I think, was probably the most worthwhile part of my whole career. But when I made the decision to leave, you feel those were projects done. They're now stable. The machines are all being used. They're in sustaining mode. So it was time to sort of leave that and pass it on to somebody else.
Yeah, I think that's a trick, isn't it, in your career, to understand when the moment is that it's time to move on. And interesting to think about that conversation we had about the head versus the gut. Did you come to the conclusion it was time to move on because it was gut-led? Was there a moment, or was it considered over a period of time? I know that was how you made the decision in the end, but was there a moment when you went, I think I need to start thinking about moving on to the next?
I put the goal of being able to retire at 55, probably in place 15 years earlier. So when I got to that sort of February, 2 or 3 months before, then it became a binary choice. And I think the two aligned. We make relatively few choices. Sometimes things just seem obvious. And the one thing I've learned from going through that process of choosing to step away from work and change of direction is that when somebody tells you, you should, and they think they're giving you advice, is that you look sort of glaze over and smile and phase out and don't listen to anything else they say, because they're putting you in their shoes or themselves in your shoes. And that's what they would do with their values, their beliefs, what they think. And when somebody says, this worked for me, can you tell me a little bit more about what you're thinking about, how you look at it? Then they're trying to understand your role, and ignoring the first set of people who start a phrase with, you should. For me now, it's a trigger phrase to glaze over.
That goes back to that unmanageable bit, doesn't it? Because it doesn't give you the freedom of choice to be able to consider the direction you want to go in. You could have said at that February point, actually, I'm not ready yet. I want to go and work somewhere else for another little period of time. But you didn't. You actually stuck with the, I've decided it's 55. I'm going now to scale back. Before we go and explore that scaling back or changing patterns and work-life balance, maybe, we talked about that 12-year project of preventing two big institutions from self-harming. What else would you say up to that point you were really proud of in your career?
I think I fixed a lot of bugs and I solved a lot of problems that customers cared about. And this goes from customers who were spraying the world with financial data to modelling the start of the universe. And I really enjoyed the customer interaction and being parachuted into a situation where there was chaos. I remember going to Italy, and I've arrived, let's say, on a Saturday morning. And on the Sunday night, one of the administrators comes up, spoke no English. And he put his arms around me and kissed me on both cheeks and gave me some chocolates and some wine and danced off after saying something in Italian. And the guy who was hosting me, who did the translation, said, so tonight is the first night for 3 months he is able to read to his children. And he was being put under an extreme amount of pressure and being able to solve at least some of the issues within reasonably short. And I was the front. I'd have had two or three other people devoted to the issue back in the office or they're working from home. But being able to make that sort of different, I found really rewarding. And I kept a list, I was told to, for promotion purposes. I did over 250 customer visits. Some would be repeat, but there was a bank in London that kept wanting me to visit over an extended period of time. And it was really nice when they sort of asked for you back.
I can hear the fondness in your voice about the connection with people. And that's another theme that's gone through your career that I do know about, because you and I first met when I was the Link Careers Advisor at Aberystwyth University for Computer Science. And you were one of the honorary fellows coming back and working with the students to help those individuals understand what they needed to be thinking about so they could transition into a career in computer science. And that's something you've done for a long time, isn't it?
So I think I've managed 24 out of 26 years for the second year computer science industrial weekend, where industrialists, which I am still one, mock interview students. So we rip apart their CVs, we'll ask them questions and try and build confidence, but to show them the gap between where they are and where they need to be. And that has been even more useful this year, because I've kind of taken the learning of 26 years, and my daughter is in Sheffield, and all they do is, you know, take your CV to careers. So we've run an additional unassessed module for her this year, where we took a CV, we looked at what the gaps were. So she went off and did a project around a crack rock climbing robot, which she's built. She's doing a robotics degree. And then I got some of my friends from Oracle, a lady from Boston in the US, and two or three other people to mock interview her. And then when she started applying, she was very successful and she had an interview. This was all a dry run for next year when she does want to get an industrial year. So I think what Aberystwyth did was groundbreaking. And I was a member of the British Computer Society Academic Accreditation Panel, which assessed degree schemes. And I didn't see anything like it. And I think allowing students to do their own sort of gap analysis between where they are and where they need to be. And in the last year, I've been doing career coaching for third year students. I call it my anthropological study of career anxiety. And I think there's, from a careers point of view, there's parts of the whole jigsaw where careers can bring something to the party. But I think they also need to have a little bit of inspiration, a little bit of somebody who's been in that industry, and they're able to talk about what they're anxious about, and often just externalizing it, they can get rid of it.
I think those are wise words, Clive. And of course, different careers advisors work different ways. And there are many careers advisors who do provide inspiration, many of whom have worked in industry. And you're absolutely right. The gap between university and first job and understanding sectors and the dynamics and protocols and so forth is significant. And it's one that if students are supported well, their university provides effectively. And ABBA's been doing that for years, hasn't it, Aberystwyth? So it's obviously something that you've enjoyed doing. It's a bit of a giving back activity in many ways, I think, and that's sort of seeing somebody develop. It's not the only thing you do, though, that's about developing and sharing ideas, is it? Because you've been running TEDx Aberystwyth for quite some time now.
Anything like that is a team effort. So I've got to give credit to Hannah and Sonia that have both joined different parts of TEDx Aberystwyth's evolution. What I found was interesting is being able to find, coach and present speakers. And so being able to stick your head into the world of somebody who writes biographies or does research into insects as food or astrophysics or whatever the many other shotgun of spread of speakers that we've had in TEDx Aberystwyth. Actually, the day itself, I would like to just stay in bed and leave to somebody else. I detest the day itself. It's pure stress and hassle, but I do it because I get to meet some really interesting people and, as I stick my head into their world for a couple of months and learn how they see the world to an extent.
Having been one of your speakers, I can understand the reference to stress on the day, but it's fascinating that the breadth of ideas that anything like TEDx and certainly TEDx Aberystwyth covers that just is captivating and I think is an extension of your love of complex problem solving, because it's that intellectual, what's the world look like through their eyes then? And obviously that people development theme again that's come through in the same way you like developing students, developing people to be able to speak effectively on the TEDx stage. So here we are now, Clive, you have got the big corporate career behind you. I'm going to use that fun word again. I think having more fun because you've got a bit more freedom, two values that we've talked about that are important to you in your career. Where are you now? What was that leap like into contracting away from working in a corporate environment? Or do you not see a difference because you've been home-based for so long?
Yeah, I mean, I've been home-based pretty much since 2005, and so doing travel as required. So, for example, COVID wasn't that different from me, just I didn't go to New York four times a year. I made a couple of conscious choices. I left Oracle on very good and agreeable terms, and really, I decided I was going to have 6 months off doing anything work-wise. And unfortunately, it started raining in July and for the whole month. But an ex-boss of mine said, would you like to do some contract work with us for 3 weeks? So that didn't go to plan. And the other thing is I basically ended up with three jobs, one in education, one very technical, one consulting, and they've all got different profiles and they fit together quite well. But I think starting the three of them up at one time had quite a lot of overhead, and I'm probably doing the right thing, but it's meant I've been busier for the last 6 months than I would have wanted to be. But then it's been winter, and winters in Wales are not fantastic.
And we're hoping it's going to stop raining soon, she said, looking out of the window and seeing grey skies again. So now you've settled into, or are nearly fully settled into, the three new roles, and summer's on the horizon. What next for you?
I live my life in kind of two phases. I try and spend about 5% in thinking. So thinking about what I'm going to do and setting the objectives and how they're going to happen. And then I try and spend the 90-95% actually doing and not questioning it unless new information comes along. And I'm very much in the do phase. I've got, it's very clear for each of the different parts how those go forward for at least the next month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months. And until I get new information, I'm just going to turn that handle. And I'm learning to kayak, sea kayak, and I've acquired a few new climbing partners, and I do a fair amount of climbing with my daughter, so I'm going to spend more time doing those. And we have a Springer Spaniel puppy who, she's not a bit more than a puppy now, who kind of call my life coach. The Springer Spaniel is full of energy. It is the dog with the most energy, and it's like, you keep up with me. And I've got a little bit back into mountain running, which I'm quite enjoying. I've got a couple of objectives of finishing the Munros in Scotland and the Hewitt in Wales, and just balancing all these things out with supporting children as best we can as they go through their university experience, and trying really not to work more than 2 days a week.
How's that going for you?
Not well at the moment, but then I think that's partly a choice, is in terms of winter and starting up three different jobs. And they've got flexibility. Well, you know, one of them, we have an agreement that I work when it rains.
Brilliant. So that's a big budget job then, if you're living in Wales.
Yeah, but it's nice that there's a synergy between them, and they're all very different.
So some more climbing, a little bit of doing. How about a bit of being? Is that on the agenda as well?
No.
Why not?
That's just not how my brain works. I have to be doing something. I don't do sitting in one place unless there's a reason for it.
So kinesthetic activity is really important to you, hence the climbing and the kayaking, yeah, and the running. There we are. And that may be what's balanced out the desk work over time to help you retain your sanity and to achieve so well. One last question for you, which is something I always ask every guest. Is there a piece of music or a quote or a film that is particularly significant to you in terms of inspiration or meaning?
No, I like something that's different. And so, for example, with music, I like to explore things that are new. So, for example, I'm listening to an obscure psychedelic Swedish band at the moment called Och. I'll forget about them and I'll move on. So I think it would be something that's new and challenging, and I very much miss still John Peel, who would challenge your ears. And that's what I think of music and inspiration, something new and challenging.
Well, I hope that moving forward, your world is full of new and challenging heights, both intellectually and physically, to run, climb, explore, and maybe kayak round as well. Thanks ever so much for your time today. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. I know there'll be a lot of rich content for people to take away and chew over. I'll share links to the various books we've mentioned in the show notes and to your favourite methodology ever. And I'll look forward to seeing you soon. Thank you, Clive.
Thank you.
Inspiration often springs from other people's stories. It ignites our inner voice so we can tune into our deepest desires. This voice isn't just intuition alone, however. If we listen carefully, our inner voice acts like a beacon lighting the way forward and encouraging us to embrace change as we pursue paths that resonate at the core of who we are. If today's story has ignited a shift in your perspective, or you know someone else it could help, please share this episode. That way, we can spread the spark of inspiration to transform careers from the daily grind into something that provides our daily joy. As a specialist career transformation coach, I'm here to walk with you step by step, both as the host of this podcast and working one-to-one with you when you're ready for change. When that time comes, just get in touch. Meanwhile, I look forward to welcoming you next time for more empowering insights and conversations with my latest guests. See you soon.